Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to make a start at this. I'm afraid that Miklos Harzati is caught in a cab in the rain, but he's on his way, and so we hope that he will be joining us momentarily. I think it's rather difficult getting a cab in the rain in London sometimes, so we keep our fingers crossed he grabs one quickly, and his chair is waiting. Meanwhile, we do want to begin because we're aware that time is ticking by. So let me simply say that we are delighted to be able to host this conversation with you on illiberal democracy in Eastern Europe. I am joined today by, on my far side over here, Jan Zalonka, who is a professor of EU politics at St. Anthony's.
European
politics, pardon me. Important distinction there, particularly in post-Brexit politics. Professor of European politics at St. Anthony's and also a Ralph Dahrendorf fellow there. We have, for the home team, as it were, Denisa Kostovikova, who is from LSE's government department, where she is an associate professor of global politics. Both have written extensively on questions having to do with democracy in Europe, and I'm sure we will benefit enormously from their insights on the theme. Miklos himself is, I'm sure as many of you know, professor from Hungary and also a very eminent individual who is engaged in the actual activities of monitoring democracy, worked for very many years with the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe as part of their free freedom of speech and media monitoring instrument. So we await him, and he is on his way, thank goodness. The topic today, and again, I'm sure many of you will recall it, I actually reread the original article myself this weekend, is inspired by Farzid Zakaria's 1997 Foreign Affairs article. And this, to put you back in the context of the time, was written in the immediate aftermath of elections in Bosnia-Herzegovina. And the article itself begins, rather tellingly, with a quote from the American diplomat, and at that time, of course, Balkan envoy, Richard Holbrooke. And he has said this comment on the eve of the September 1996 elections in Bosnia, which were, of course, meant to restore civic life to be a move towards democratization. And Holbrooke said, and I quote, "Suppose the election was declared free and fair, but those elected are racist, fascist, separatists who are publicly opposed to peace and reintegration. That is the dilemma." And that's Holbrooke in 1996. So looking back at that article, and of course reading it from the perspective of 2017, it certainly struck me how much of what already Zakaria was observing and suggesting could well be an important development in terms of the way that we experience democracy. Democracy has, of course, increased in terms of the numbers of purportedly democratic states, but that hasn't necessarily meant that they've moved towards liberal constitutional democracy, and it may well be that the illiberal democracy that Farzid Zakaria originally proposed is a more apropos way of thinking of this. So, without further ado, I'll ask first Denisa,
first me, okay,
and then Jan to give us just a few short remarks, about 10 minutes each,
sure,
and hopefully by the time they've both finished, we will be joined by Miklos, and then we will open for comments from the floor. I should also say, I always forget this bit, we have a hashtag. Of course, our hashtag is right up on the screen. It is hashtag LSE Democracy. We are also podcasting this event, so when it does come time to the Q&A, if you could please wait until one of the stewards gives you the microphone, and if you could also please very briefly identify yourself, that would be much appreciated.
Okay, thank you, Jennifer, and thank you for inviting me to contribute to this discussion. So in my 10 minutes, I will tackle three questions. What is the liberal democracy? And maybe going sort of away from Zakaria, how we have come to understand it, or I understand it. Where does it come from, and what does the future hold? And empirically, I'll be drawing on my research in the Balkans, which also incidentally inspired that original article. So I think it's quite fascinating that since this term was first coined and presented, we've had a proliferation of terms that describe something that attempts to look like democracy, but it's not quite. And every year, at the beginning of school year, I challenge my students to find another term, and I just give them a long list. So starting with the liberal democracy, we now discuss qualified democracy, pseudo-democracy, hybrid democracy, low-intensity democracy, electocracy, facade democracy, and I could go on. So it's really interesting. This really reflects, I think, an intellectual effort on part of the people who are thinking about this issue to really grasp what it is, what kind of system it is that isn't really that authoritarian or totalitarian system, but really isn't something that we instinctively recognize as democracy on a Western model. So what I'd like to do is just say how I feel, what is so illiberal about democracy, drawing on my empirical research. And I can now see that the panel is complete. So I think the essence of this kind of qualified democracy is not necessarily the lack of freedom, but the limitations of freedom. And we can talk about three such limitations: the limitations on political freedom, on economic freedom, and something that I call freedom of movement or freedom to be secure. So first, political freedom. When we talk about democracy, we obviously focus on the rights and freedoms of expression, freedom of media, freedom for sexual minorities. I mean, just recently you could see many Eastern European countries having problems on the LGBT International Day. But for me, what I find very interesting, that even if we take concepts such as electocracy that say, well, it's fine to have the elections, when you dig deeper, even the elections are problematic. And, for example, in many elections in the Balkans, you may be aware that people are asked to actually take a photo of the vote that they've, you know, whatever they've crossed, as a proof, because there is an informal pressure to pledge loyalty to a party, but also to perform that loyalty. So it's not just a lip service. So on the one hand, it's this kind of pernicious limitations of political freedoms in every single sense. Secondly, I would say it's the economic freedom. And here I wouldn't say an economic freedom in a sense of choosing whether you go to very, very kind of harsh sort of neoliberal model or maybe just modified. What I mean very simply is an individual's possibility and freedom to choose the job they want to do, assuming, of course, that they're qualified and capable of doing it. Illiberal democracies or qualified democracies with their shaky rule of law are also poor economic performers with scarce job. And in such conditions, one gets a job, but not necessarily because they're qualified or able to do that job, but because they're connected. And most commonly in these contexts, people are connected to political parties. And political parties does not necessarily act or embody the expressions of interest or political ideology. They also work as job centers, as employment machines. And this is why I think it's really important to stress that external observers, for example, get baffled when they see a result, such as we've seen in the last elections in Macedonia, where the party that was exposed for its horrendous corruption actually got most votes. And lastly is this kind of freedom of movement and freedom to be secure, especially in multi-ethnic societies. where, as in the Balkans, where it is the boundaries of one ethnic community is actually the physical limit of where one would comfortably go and cross. So, of course, this can be also boundaries between the states. But again, this is the sense, this, as I said, sort of the pernicious limitations of a very sort of freedom, but from the perspective of security. So, of course, it's not completely, it's not the dark day of totalitarianism where there was no freedom, where every aspect of one's life was controlled. But, of course, it's not freedom. And that's that kind of space, very insecure space that one has to navigate, kind of forgetting any kind of political principles. So I go to my second question. Where does it come from? And, of course, it's very easy to look at the whole Eastern Europe as a monolith, just as sort of a European identity has become sort of a category that kind of flattens out all the differences. And, of course, one of my favorite books of all times is actually a book called Return to Diversity, written by Joseph Rothschild, a historian who was working at Columbia University, who actually destroyed the myth of Eastern Europe being monolithic, but during communism, you know, when everybody looked at communism and said that's exactly the same. And this book was crucial, and as a matter of fact, just appeared as, you know, the end of communism is coming. And it actually showed that not only was the communism the same in all these countries, but also how communism ended in them was different. You know, you can just compare Romania and Hungary and Yugoslavia, etc. But of course, the paths of these countries diverge. So, of course, I don't want to kind of go now and be specific and speak of each country, but we can see now sort of a division that has, in a way, divided Eastern Europe and how we understand transition. And that is, I would say, conflict in former Yugoslavia. And this whole area, what has now come to be called Balkans, which is quite interesting because previously we just talked about a single country. What happened was that the legacy of conflict got folded into the transition from communism. So we have two different transitions happening, both from war and both from a totalitarian system, of which my colleague Vesna Bojacic-Jalilovic, who is here, have written extensively about, and which makes it very difficult, both for academics and policymakers alike, to kind of sift through this complexity of these two transitions in order to kind of find out how do we A, explain what's going on. So very often you hear both the academics and policymakers saying, well, you know, enough with these post-conflict places. We are 20 years on after the war. We shouldn't even call them post-conflict. We should talk about just a straightforward democratic transition. But that just shows you that on the one hand, so we have this separation that I think Balkans cannot be treated and understood in the same way as, for example, let's say Hungary or Poland or Slovakia or the other countries that didn't go through conflict. So I do think that we do have this division there emerging. And from there, one could actually ask a very, very relevant question when it comes, where do we come from? When we look at illiberal democracy in the Balkans as opposed in the rest of the Eastern Europe, are we talking about, and I would argue in the case of the Balkans, the fact that really democracy never really took root, so we really never had consolidated democracy, as opposed to these other places, countries in Eastern Europe, where we can more correctly, I think, talk about backsliding. If we take, for example, European membership to be kind of, you know, a measure, an indicator that you know, however young this democracy has reached some level that kind of approximate this Western model. So I will conclude by saying, and yes, and I just want to make a small but a very important point about the Balkans. You know, the reason is sort of this debate kind of, let's just call it transition, let's not talk about post-conflict reconstruction, is quite problematic because this violent legacy full of war crimes cannot be just wished away. It's there constantly. And it's fascinating that even 25 years after the war, because there hasn't been proper transitional justice, proper reconciliation, and proper reckoning, we have a very vicious nationalist discourse that really is directed against the ethnic others, but also stifles domestic dissent. So that is, you know, so that is the background against which kind of, you know, you expect democracy to emerge. So there is a huge question, kind of, you know, in terms of, you know, how you come, you know, address this legacy, and, you know, how you will proceed. You know, in other words, as Tytel, for example, has argued, that addressing the criminal legacy and how you do this is very much constitutive of your path towards democracy. So my last point in half a minute is, what does the future hold? Well, of course, I don't have a crystal ball and cannot say, nor would I believe it probably if I had it. But I can just see kind of two aspects that can help us think where this illiberal democracy in Eastern Europe, specifically in the Balkans, could go. So at the beginning, I said, when I mentioned all these qualified democracy terms, I said they deviate from the Western model. But now I have to make a caveat, because what has started happening is that some Western democracies, at least with discourse and a little bit with policies, are all of a sudden beginning to look a little bit more like us. In other words, like us in, let's say, the illiberal bits of Eastern Europe. So instead of having the dynamics that Eastern Europe is approximating them, I think we now have a sense that, as I said, you know, all of a sudden, it's really kind of, kind of interesting that you could hear a nationalist discourse, and there was a lot of it, for example, before the Brexit vote, even in the UK. And of course, you may know that some of the staunchest supporters of Trump can be found in the Balkans. So for me, this is really interesting, because this kind of normative model for others to kind of approximate is not as kind of clear as it used to be. And I think that's quite problematic. Many of you may have seen the findings from a recent survey that was done by Pew Research Center in the US, and they asked whether democracy is a preferable form of government. And the findings were absolutely astounding. Lithuania, out of the Eastern Europeans, sort of tipped the board, and in which 64% people said yes, that democracy is preferable form of government. In Serbia, only 25% said. The median was below 50%. So in a way, this kind of gray democracy is also kind of devaluing the value of democracy. And I'm finishing. So can this system of rule endure? That's another question. So is it here to stay? And some of my colleagues who are based at Graz did this big study, and they actually coined, to my excitement, a new term. They called it stabilocracy. Kind of, you have stability through this kind of local semi-authoritarianism, authoritarian leaders, authoritarians, who are supported by, for example, EU, who says that you're fine as long as everything is stable. But I think this is very problematic. I mean, no system that doesn't care about human dignity, improving people's lives, can survive in the long term. And I think it's only a question of time where people will stop and rebel. Now, what will they fight for next, whether they will fight for democracy or something else, it's a different question. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I will try to grab for you what's unique in Hungary's illiberal governance, but first of all, I have to state that although I am a fellow of CEU's centers on media studies and on European studies, I'm not speaking in the name of CEU, just as I'm not speaking in the name of Columbia University or the United Nations or OSCE, where I'm also affiliated, this or that way. My views on both the situation of the university and on the government of Hungary are solely mine. This statement may sound as self-evident and redundant, but believe me, it does not in Hungary, where the government and its media empire just yesterday labeled the resolution of the European Parliament critical of Hungary as, of Hungary's politics, to be precise, as ordered and paid for by George Soros. Is that a unique story? Mr. Soros is designated in today's Hungary the principal public enemy, responsible for every evil, just as Emmanuel Goldstein was created for that role in George Orwell's 1984, or Imam Fethullah Gulen is in today's Turkey, or Trotsky was for the Soviet Union. Actually, the storyline, too, is repeating Orwell's, because just as Goldstein used to be an ally of Big Brother back in times that nobody is allowed to remember, George Soros, in the late 80s and early 90s, had paid for Viktor Orban's education in Oxford and financed the setup of his Fidesz party. So, not even Orban's U-turn is unique. Neither is Orbanism unique as a personalist regime. It's just Putinist, Erdoganist, Nazarbayevist, Aliyevist. You only have to look for the coalition of the non-willing in the Human Rights Council of the United Nations, and you have the whole and actually perpetually growing list. Hungary's type of system is also no novelty. It is branded under so many scholarly names. Viktor Orban himself calls it illiberal democracy. That's quite unique. Borrowing Farid Zakaria's term created in 1997 when he described a new type of despoilment of democracy. Orban in 2014 in a famous speech reinterpreted the term as real democracy after decades of Western mental imperialism and named Russia and Turkey as its pioneers. If this type of system is viewed by scholars as a type of democracy, because you have elections after all, then it is categorized as sovereign or managed or hybrid, or if it is considered authoritarianism, then its name could be elective or competitive authoritarianism in the books, because after all, you have elections. Or you can simply see it as a reverse mafia state which creates its resources to be looted and the ways to loot via laws passed in parliament. Nearest came the definition of the less scholarly Bill Clinton, who famously commented on Orban's 2014 illiberal speech on Jon Stewart's Daily Show like this. And there's the authoritarian capitalism model, which is Russia and in a different way China, and it has some appeal, like the Hungarian prime minister who just said he liked authoritarian capitalism, just saying, I don't ever want to have to leave power. Usually those guys want to stay forever and make money. So here is what absolutely unique about Orbán's system. Hungary, unlike all other countries governed by illiberals, until Orbán's arrival, Hungary is a member state of the European Union, member of the very bloc where liberal constitutionalism is not only the norm, but is the contracted and sworn value set. All institutional and cultural guarantees of liberal constitutionalism get consciously and methodically eliminated. Yet Orbán can get away with that precisely by using Brussels' many blessings. The Union serves as his main enemy image that he whips up in a paroxysm of patriotic propaganda. At the same time, he uses the ineptitude and under-resourced legal power of the Union to obstruct the consequences of his two-faced play. And he lets the Union litigate against this systemic plague on a case-by-case, piecemeal way, even gaining thereby some legitimacy of being part of the European rule of law. And best of all, he has not needed so far caring about actually producing the resources to be plundered via a competitive economy, because Hungary's membership in the Union cares for the bounty. All economists agree that without the euro billions of cohesion and investment contributions from Brussels, Hungary would not have produced any GDP growth this decade. Orbán uses the membership incomes to both bring the economy to a modest growth and to enrich his chosen oligarchs and his own family's frontmen. Here are a few achievements of Hungary's illiberal democracy, schemed and overseen single-handedly by its extraordinarily energetic prime minister. Since 2010, the system of governance in Hungary managed to pass Hungary's first one-party constitution after 25 years against the will of all other parties, removed the word republic from the official name of Hungary, passed the media law, which put the regulation and licensing of all the media under an intransparent media council with five people on board delegated solely by his party. Overtly passed taxpayer money to chosen oligarchs tasked to buy up independent media and turn them into government propaganda tools. Or the reverse way, just in the case of the country's best newspaper, Népszabadság, to obliterate them from existence. Named the chief prosecutor who has stonewalled so far all and every corruption cases involving the government. Removed the chief judge and took away the court system's self-government. Actually, nationalized and centralized all self-governments in the country, existing since democratization of the late 80s, for example, in culture, art, education, and more topically about the CEU problem, the autonomy of universities. Deprived the Constitutional Court of its jurisdiction over all budgetary and financial issues. Later, it banned the court from using the case law of the last 20 years. And finally, enlarged the court and packed it with his party's nominees. Well, many autonomous services have been headed by now with nominees by Viktor Orbán, all of them for 9 years, renewable limitlessly. Hungary copied the Russian crackdown against watchdog NGOs. Legislation today, as we talk, is pending to label them foreign paid. This is nothing less than the new Iron Curtain against international civilian contracts, revived in a different form after 25 years, built this time not of concrete like the Berlin Wall, but of legal provisions on the citizen level, has been extended, this Iron Curtain, to the West, into the middle of the European Union. Under the watch of the European Union, the government has subordinated its energy sector to Russia through a long series of secret deals personally cut between Vladimir Putin and Viktor Orban. Probably all of you have heard about the hate campaign waged against refugees. This is something of particular pride to Viktor Orban because not one country to the west of Hungary has copied the way. Weaponizing an indignant xenophobia, refugees are portrayed in countless ways in the media empire, on the streets, in giant billboards, as potential terrorists, actual lawbreakers, pseudo-victims, and otherwise tools invited to Hungary by the multinational capital and the left-wingers of the world bent to ruin this unique nation of Hungary through liberalism and multiculturalism, which actually, the campaign states, had already ruined the West. And while we show the world how to remain migrant-free and culturally separate and homogeneous, we Hungarians nevertheless also do this defending European Christianity. And this campaign was kept recently by legally barring from asylum status anyone entering Hungary from neighboring countries, all of which have been declared safe by Parliament. And finally, it ordered the automatic detention in a tight borderline zone, all who nevertheless did try their good luck. So, I have to, if I have one more minute, I would like to compare Orban, probably also famous, referendum on the migrant issue and on Europe with this country's also quite famous referendum. In a seemingly Cameroonian way, Orban asked the citizens of Hungary about Brussels' migration policies. To be precise, the ballot asked the citizens about a non-existent, fictionalized European Union refugee policy, namely a diktat to deploy millions of migrants against the will of Hungarians. But he did not commit David Cameron's fatal mistake of putting the European membership actually on directly on the ballot. And then citing an overwhelming plebiscitarian support despite the legal invalidity of the referendum, Orban proclaimed Hungary's special status on refugee policy a fait accompli. And by achieving that, he got from the European Union the practical waiver that David Cameron aimed at from integration itself. He achieved the goal of a practical license of the Union for its member states to suspend their contracts as it pleases them. Now, this is quite unique. One cannot imagine a stranger paradox than having to go against any convention of liberal constitutionalism and do this inside the European Union. And finally, the fate of CEU. You all heard probably about the legal amendments passed literally overnight. To be very precise, distributed to the members of Parliament Friday evening and decided early next week. Ostensibly, in the name of equalizing the status of all foreign higher educational ventures in Hungary, it practically squeezes out the Central European Union of Hungary because in the very last moment before the vote, even pressing deadlines were squeezed into the law. And that means that in August, of all academic months, the university will have to comply with the conditions that, of course, it cannot comply. You must know how thankful the Central European Union and the whole Hungarian academic community is for the solidarity expressed by the LSE as well and many academia in Western Europe. I think you should be continuing to watch out and provide any support you can in the hope to save what can be saved. Thank you so much for your attention.
A few years ago, I visited famous historic city of Malacca. It's interesting because it has these traces of Malaysian, Portuguese, and Dutch culture. And at a certain moment, I came across something that was called Museum of Democracy. I thought, oh, I want to see that. I was told it was closed. You know, Viktor Orban was already in power in Hungary by the time, but we didn't imagine that Farid Zakaria's words would apply more to Donald Trump, his native country, than to Malaysia or Macedonia. And this is where we are. There are local variations of those. We usually grapple with our own native countries because we care more, right? And when Miklos and I were basically campaigning for human rights still in the era of communism, we heard very often in this country, well, you know, even if communism fails, you just won't get out of this. And indeed not. I think I will die post-communist, as a post-communist. Although in Italy, nobody talks about Italy as a post-fascist country, you know. So how much time it takes to liberate yourself from autocratic legacy is an interesting question. But the truth is that with all horrible things which we read daily in Hungary, Poland, Slovakia in particular, in this region I come from, in this very country, we read articles about judges who are enemies of the people because they've done what they are constitutionally supposed to do. Nobody else but Theresa May has a speech calling for national elections. She declared, well, the country is united, but the Westminster is divided. I always thought that in a parliament you are supposed to have, you know, different parties opposing each other. And so there is something which is very peculiar. And those of us, however we may dislike the governments in Poland and Hungary, should ask themselves the question, well, how come they won elections? Yes, I agree with Farid that democracy is not only about elections. Certainly not. But democracy without elections is something peculiar too, yeah? So we have to face this somehow. How come that those of us who believe in something we call liberal democracy are no longer, in many cases, convince the electorate that, that what we believe democracy is really the only thing what should be is no longer in vogue, so to speak, right? You know, there are, you know, something like 500 adjectives to democracy, but we always thought the democracy is not just about elections, but the rule of law, division of power, check of balances, that, that basically, majority of the day cannot rule the country as they wish, right? That they are bounded by constitutional constraint, that minorities have certain rights, that power is being divided, right? But somehow, Viktor Orban and some others are being proud to say, we don't believe in liberal democracy any longer. So I think, you know, instead of giving you litany, sadokistic litany of things which go wrong in Poland or Slovakia, I think we should look at this briefly. What has gone wrong? And I see a lot of things which we should consider here, not only in Central Eastern Europe, although this is probably our main topic today, but in other countries too. Let's look at the system of representation. How does it function? And let's look at the political parties, which used to be a bridge between society and elites. Are there still, how many of students here are members of political parties? You see what I mean? They are no longer performing the functions we thought, you know, for them to meet. They are no longer, they become, as my late friend and colleague Peter Meyer called it, they are becoming cartel parties. They are there to win elections, usually using sophisticated PR techniques, and to sell to electorate whatever they want to buy, so to speak, right? Look at parliaments. You know, in this country, you know, this is the mother of parliaments, Westminster. And yet, there was this consistent effort to make sure that the parliament has not say on certain things, right? In particular here in the questions of Brexit. But things were further, you know. A lot of decisions gradually were transferred to non-majoritarian institutions. What are they? Constitutional courts, central banks, European Commission, right? Maybe the balance is no longer as it used to be. Maybe people do not really think that they can influence decision through elections. Because there is always another non-elected body which will tell you, okay, I know that you, Mr. Corbyn or Mr. Orban, you want to do this, but this is not really possible. But things are even worse if you look into economics. Politicians campaign in elections, they want to promise you a pension or housing or health service, but they cannot deliver. We blame globalization for this. But come on, we were leaders of globalization. We privatized, deregulated, you know, basically have done, Bob can tell you all about this, done all these things which constrain ability of a state to have effective economic policy. Right? These were not Chinese who have done it. We have done it, right? And then look at other issues. Look at discourse on migration. Well, I agree that what some politicians ruling politicians in Poland and Hungary are saying about migrants is absolutely disgraceful. Well, but I'm afraid I heard a lot of liberal politicians saying bad things about migrants too. Mr. Rutte, I'm also not just Polish but also Dutch, you see. Mr. Rutte in Holland won elections, and Christian Democrats too, by basically adopting a rhetoric of Mr. Wilders. And he even said, well, good populists won over the bad one. Thank you very much. Maybe people will opt tomorrow for the real thing, yeah? As they opted in Hungary. And look at international affairs, our liberal values of multilateralism. How liberal Democrats were basically engaging in military adventures based on the cooked out evidence. And often open lies to the parliaments. These are not fake news or fake facts. This is not post-truth. This all has happened. And the question is how to regain, in all these different countries, credibility before the voters after all these things what happened. My country, Poland, is a very good example. Unlike Greece, the economy didn't collapse 25%. Poland grew 25% last decade. The problem is, what was not publicized all the time, that this is also a leader in zero-hour contracts. Precariat is the rule of the game in Poland. And you can go on and on those issues and ask yourself, how is it possible that voters started to support people like Kaczynski and Orban? And unless we answer those questions honestly, I think we will not regain credibility among our electorate. And we may end up in a museum of democracy.
Thank you very much. I'm conscious we started late, so I want to now immediately go to questions. And I would like to collect up 3-4 questions before we come back to the panel. So please remember, we are podcasting this. The ushers have the various microphones. Please wait until you have a microphone. And please also do briefly introduce yourself. And because we're short of time, questions rather than long statements would be appreciated. Yes, lady in the back.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. My name is Kira Gardzu. I'm a PhD student at the European Institute. And my question is for Professor Miklos. So the question is, what should the European Union do to support the efforts of those Hungarians who are trying to push the regime towards a more liberal direction? And the reason why I'm asking is because from your speech, I understood that, the European Union should do the maximum it can, given its powers, to punish and isolate the Hungarian government, at least in whatever areas it is violating European law, including the violation of the relocation mechanism. But on the other hand, I've been to several events recently about Turkey, where several Turkish academics have urged the European Union instead to engage with the Turkish government, because they believe that, that if all links are severed, nothing will be left to push Turkey into a democratic direction. So I wanted to ask, where do you stand on this issue? Thank you.
There's a gentleman in the front.
Thank you. I'm a student at King's College London, and my question is to Miklos, who last I heard was the UN Special Rapporteur for Affairs in Belarus. Yep, Great. Well, as we know, Belarus is neither liberal nor democratic, but recently it's made concessions to the EU and to the United States in its balancing act between Russia and the West. And I was just curious to hear your views on the prospects of genuine democratization. Well, I think it was just yesterday or today that a major opposition group was finally given official status as a political movement. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Thank you. I'm the Hungarian ambassador, so I felt a bit personally addressed by Horace Miklós's speech. I'm one of those political appointees, not for 9 years, but maybe a bit shorter. I have a few remarks on some of the things that sat here, but I know it's question times, so maybe either I make my remarks in a form of question, or maybe at some point I could make a few points. I don't know what your suggestion is there.
Well, I think that would probably be at the end, because we do want to bring in as many voices as we can.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Any questions?
Yes. Lady over here, please.
It was just, you said that why do people vote for those parties? We need to raise that question and answer it honestly. Could you try to answer it for us, please? Your opinion.
And then one last question and we'll come back to the panel.
Jan Kubik, UCL CIS. A very similar question to this one. There's this famous article by Engelhardt and Norris which shows that the economic explanations do not work as well as cultural explanations, that the problem is really in some cultural disappointment rather than the, say, economic inequality. Where do you stand on that?
All three of you, if you may.
Miklos, you want to begin?
Yeah. The last question was not to me, right?
It was to everyone.
To everyone. Let me start with that one very, very briefly. Yes, there is a fatigue, the noise of democracy in new democracies is something that people were not expecting, especially when delivering the desired living standards is not coming about very quickly. And that produces the notion of losers of the change, which is the bounty of the populists. This is their base. All their task is to enhance that base by producing losers, real or unreal ones, and I'm sorry to say, invariantly, those people gather votes by utilizing the basest instincts, which are probably universal, but some of them are quite regional in those countries torn by history and kind of built in pride and prejudice. The electoral system also plays a role, but that's a different chapter. So, answering that question, I believe the European Union was designed in a hasty way and in the naive belief that once democracy, then always democracy. You know about, it's much better defined, the deficiencies which happened during the when they devised the euro, or and many other issues that, of course, also play a role here. But in this domain, the most important thing is they do not have the tool called systemic violation. They only have a piecemeal approach, case by case, as in a rule of law country. You are breaching the tax laws, then there is litigation against you, and you settle it in a certain way, and after you settle it, you are sinful again, you are part of the system. The system works. And this is how it was devised. You see, we couldn't imagine a conscious, deliberate, systemic despoilment of democracy. And they should develop it. If they don't develop that, if they don't develop the tool, then the European Union is lost on one more account, because there are several. Regarding Belarus, I believe that, because I have that position, I'm not supposed to be political about this. I can afford to be patriotic about Hungary, and even passionate. But with Belarus, I believe that is an established systemic violation of human rights. The country has devised an illiberal tool that actually is a laboratory of those loyally ways of dictatorship, has a system that for 20 years has lamed civil society. It's a permission-based system of anything that is public, and it's a triple system because you are not able to do anything publicly that is not permitted explicitly. Permission is difficult, impossible to get, with some exceptions, as you just mentioned. And finally, it's criminalized if you do that nevertheless. De facto, every freely acting person in Belarus de facto may not be treated as a criminal, but de jure is, and that can be actualized any moment. And that system has not changed and is not going to change until you have probably this type of government. It would be a real sea change if this government would start truly reforming the sea.
Thank you. Denise.
Okay, so we were asked as a panel whether cultural explanations or economic explanations, do their explanatory work. I think it's a problem to put it in either or. I think it's so. If we look at, I think this is a really puzzling moment, not just in Eastern Europe, but let's say if we look at the Brexit vote. How can it be that the politics that addresses the marginalized, who are economically marginalized, but you could say that they're also culturally marginalized and stigmatized. So how is it that the politics that should be most progressive, right, being aimed at listening to the voice of those who are voiceless, instead of being progressive, becomes regressive? And I think it's because it's captured. So in terms of what happened here, it had nothing to do with representation. It had all to do with the political capture. And I think this is why when we, for example, study conflict studies, it's really interesting that we don't really talk about politicians. We talk about political entrepreneurs because they really realized, you know, the benefits of kind of targeting those constituencies. So that would be my answer.
Yeah.
Look, Adam Michnik, when he was recently, Adam Michnik, which is editor of Gazeta Wyborcza, one of the most distinguished democracy campaigner and good friend of mine, but when he was recently asking Gazeta Wyborcza how candidate lost, the people didn't support him and his political allies, but the other government, he said, oh, you know, it is like with this drunk woman who goes to bed with a bastard. I have to tell you, if this is understanding what has happened, it's rather a poor one. And I have to say this about very distinguished person and good friend, because the last thing, you know, I'm not even talking about the sexist element of this, but, you know, but the idea that just electorate is stupid and you cannot entrust it is for me not democratic. And I know stories about Hitler winning election. I know all of this, yeah? But we are not there. And particularly in our region, to say that we are kind of culturally not ready for democracy, you cannot make democracy without Democrats, well, I don't buy it either. Because communists collapsed not because Star Wars and Reagan, and not because of Schmidt trying to make a deal with the Soviets through the tank. Communists largely collapsed because people resisted it. Because there was a quest for freedom and basic democratic values, and we shouldn't deny this. Yeah? And yes, there were other factors too, but you know, you remember when people in Baltic countries were making human chain and candles in windows, the Sovietologists were saying, "Oh, you want to win democracy with the Soviet Union through human chain and candles in the windows?" But history proved them wrong, right? But it doesn't mean, of course, that the electorate will always ask, act in a perfect way. In particular, some of politicians take electorate for granted. And the reasons are always complex. I try to say that if people feel that they have a vote, but they don't have voice, they are unhappy. That is how democracy is dying. And this is easier said than done, how to make them feel that they have some ownership in this project. It's not easy, particularly now that, you know, that nation states don't control transnational economics, communication. It's more complicated. And we are at the same time kind of in all this transnational environment are dismantling the only transnational authority we have in Europe, which is the European Union. So it's all complicated, but I know that you have to start with your own electorate, because you don't win back your electorate going to Brussels. And I'm the last one who would say that Western government should be apologetic about what is going on in Hungary and Poland. And I'm actually annoyed when I see that those politicians are getting red carpets, because they will be now maybe acting like Trojan horse in European Union for interest within Brexit or so. I am appalled by this. You have to stick to your principle and call autocratic policies by their name. But at the same time, I just don't believe that the electorate in various countries will be, you know, change their mind because European Commission or Parliament adopts this and that resolution. And frankly, what they did, I'm happy that the European Parliament finally has taken a stance on Hungary, but I fear they are bluffing, because they don't have majority in the council. Not even qualified majority, let alone unanimity. So this is where we are. But I don't worry about this, because governments were making deals with a lot of Western governments were making deals with a lot of autocrats in the past. And yet, democracy came through because people do not want to live in an oppressive system. But they don't stand for liberty if they say that this liberty is for the few and not for the many. And if the system they believe doesn't function the way they basically would endorse. And this is how it is.
I'm going to abuse my chair's action momentarily. And I would add the criticism to that point, and that sort of the fact that there is an inherent problem in democracy in terms of its very majoritarianism. There is always that temptation, of course, for the majority to abuse the rights of the minority. And there's a very interesting comment sort of Danny Roderick made with respect to illiberal democracy, where he pointed out exactly that the civil liberties are disproportionately those that are enjoyed and valued by the minorities, and they tend to be the first to go. And, you know, I work quite closely with the High Commissioner for National Minorities. And again, you can see this.
But autocracy is the role of minority over majority. So it is not so simple, eh?
No, but it's not. But you can't say that it's just going to be the people as a majority.
But I don't say the people. This I never said. But you want to understand why the voters are abandoning us. We have to understand that certain things do not function as we claim they do. I was the first one who said, you know, democracy is not the majority of the day. There should be balance of, you know, check and balances. There should, you know, there should be constitutional rights for minorities and so on. Having said that, you know, certain things have went too far, in my view. And there was a rhetoric and there was reality. And people vote with their feet. And we may not like it, but we have to analyze this, because otherwise we will, you know, this whole idea, you know, in Poland, for instance, now, okay, we will not win elections, but we will protest to that and they will collapse. I already see my friends, you know, journalists and actors fighting on the street with nationalists, yeah? I can tell you, the latter know how to operate buttons, yeah? So, come on.
Hi. Any more questions? And I know there is a right of reply, and I will come back to it. Yes.
My name is David Morrison. I used to run a department which was involved in anti-corruption and white-collar crime in the UK, working for the UK Public Service. Not wanting to sound rather in the spirit of the arrogance of the ignorant in this arena, of which I'm not familiar. But is it really helpful to talk about illiberal democracy? I mean, listening with respect to what everybody's said, it seems to me that there's rather a lot of fake democracy around. And the issue is, how do we move from fake democracy, if Trump was here, towards proper democracy?
Bazar, University of Oxford. My question is primarily to Professor Zielonka here, but I'm also very much open to hear everyone else's opinions. So I'm thinking, if someone puts illiberal democracy on their flag, like Mr. Orban did, they must have some sort of a positive image of what illiberal means. And maybe this positive image is defined against what liberal means, but I haven't really heard much about what the sort of liberal is that Mr. Orban or others don't like. Because I can't imagine anyone fighting for a dark side. There must be a positive version to that story. So I would be interested in seeing what you think is their positive, is their sort of, view of the, or, you know, sort of image of the future. Thank you.
All right, right of reply, but I'm also conscious we've got just 10 minutes left. So,
no.
2 minutes, and then if you want to speak to the panel after we're over, I'm sure that would be.
Thank you very much. First of all, thank you very much for the invitation, and thank you very much for the chance to address some of the thoughts here. We have heard so many horrible things about this poor country that I rush to assure you that sometimes the sun still shines in that poor country, and it's not that bad at all. It's actually a very cool country. And here we heard a list of, especially in Mr. Harasti's approach, because I liked very much the two academic approaches, a totally biased political list of of wounds of a political side there, which views are largely, you know, discussed in Hungary all over in a free press. You meet these arguments all the time, and we constantly see how does it resonate with the electorate. We see the results. I don't want to enter in that. I'd like to state here that our country is a free and democratic country, which is operating under democratic circumstances. There have been elections in which the results we know. This is a liberal democracy, in my view. I'm not an academic. I'm just a political appointee here. But I believe that it is a liberal democracy, but maybe illiberal in the sense that it is such a democracy when not the liberals have won, but a Christian Democratic Conservative coalition has won, and therefore I think this distinction explains a little bit the point here.
I think we'll probably have to end there because I'm aware of the time.
Yes.
And I want to give the panel the kind of final comments. And then, as I said, at the end, if you would like to come down and speak to anybody.
Yes, just one more remark on the CEU, because that list that has been listed here was really very weak. I mean, none of them was really supported by arguments. And even that last statement which was said that the CEU has to meet conditions which are impossible is not true. Because some of the conditions that are required now have already been met. There were intergovernmental relations, intergovernmental agreements earlier, and it's not impossible to do them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, ask the panel to say their concluding remarks, and maybe we'll go kind of in reverse. So, Jan, Denisa, and then close.
No, I haven't answered Jan's questions on culture, economics. Like you, I don't believe that there is one factor. What I know, if I look at certain mistakes, although more in Poland than in Hungary, of liberal circus, is that they really haven't recognized the division between state and church. They idealize the image of a nation and its history. And this, of course, makes it unavoidable to enter on the domain of symbolic politics, where compromises are much more difficult and emotions are high. And I think if we will go this route, I see things in a black color. Having said that, I agree with this criticism of liberal ideas, which saw only individuals and not communities. And I think liberals had always little to say about communitarian spirit, and there were many liberals who criticized this too. And there was a problem, how to go about this, we don't know. I would be the last one who would ignore a community. But democracy, at the end of the day, is about less about economics and culture, but about institutions and law. The problem is how to balance those things. And we don't know. Because, you see, when I look at the current, and this is the last sentence I'm going to say, the current kind of relief, the Macron won in France, and Merkel is going to win in Germany, and of course that all this threat of illiberal populism is being contained. I actually don't think that this is so easy. I will believe that I will want to give benefit of the doubt to Macron. But I think that in order to get out of the problems we face, in local variations, of course, will only be solved if we are able to have a new model of democracy and capitalism, and European integration, I should add. Unless we come with this and with a plausible solution, we are not going to get out of these problems, but what I see is only finger pointing. And there is a dialogue of death. There's this very strong cultural divide between counter-revolutionary insurgents and the liberal elite. And you can see it in America, you can see it in France, you can see it in this country too, and certainly in Poland and Hungary. Yeah? And I don't think this can be solved just only by preaching. You need to have an idea how to revive democracy for the 21st century with economics and society and culture as we have. And we don't have this. We didn't even start the discussion. We just punch each other and I would say this is largely not politicians' fault, not even bankers' fault. It is intellectual fault. Because we are supposed to come with paradigms, yeah? And where are they?
Okay, so I will just briefly address your question, which I thought was spot on, because when we talk about illiberal democracy, we define all these kind of qualified democracies in negative terms. We know what it isn't, but we are still trying to get a handle on what really it is, and therefore understand it better to know what the recipe is. But I do have to just say one other thing about this topic of CU. As a proud graduate of CU, from what I've studied about democracy, not in my context, which was the Balkan context, it's very interesting. I talked in my presentation about freedom, but there is a flip coin to freedom, and that is fear. So why is it? So if you look at controls on academic freedom, you could look at it from the perspective of liberty, but you could also look at it from the perspective of fear. Why see you so dangerous, and why are universities usually the first places where politicians try to control? So just kind of leave the question open. Maybe this story tells us of CU something else. Maybe that the regimes are not as strong, even despite the electoral support.
So I agree that recent elections in Western Europe would not necessarily lead to a relief from the illiberal plague, especially not in Eastern Europe, where a mighty effect which did work miracles in Western Europe is not present, namely called Donald Trump. In Western Europe, the effect how Trump works, how does it look, the disturbing effect, I believe, has worked on voters' mind in ways that are not accounted for and probably are not accountable for. I would say that invariantly these regimes are not simply about personal power and staying in power as long as they can by any means, and that's simply what is illiberalism is about, by any means. That's what it is about. But they are also about personal and family and clan enrichment. And this is the point where electorates are not buying in. This is the invariantly all so-called color revolutions, although they were heating up. What are color revolutions? They are kind of civil
society upheavals against illiberal, stolen or fake democracies, where indignation about what since Ukraine is called the effect of the golden toilet brush is going high, and very interestingly, they are always coupled with a democracy moment, typically stolen or fake elections. And that's how they come about. And since the mid-2000s, these regimes are very consciously preparing for that moment with the leadership of Vladimir Putin, who has devised methods. Usually these regimes start when parties are already done, when they are already food for the machine, when they are just fillings in parliament. And what really counts is independent media and independent civil society, partly because fresh power comes from them, and partly because corruption can be revealed only if you have at least one free broadcast channel. In the original color revolution in Serbia, it was B92. In Ukraine, it was Channel 5. It was Rustavi 2 in Georgia. And so these regimes are very consciously striving toward elimination of any kind of independent watchdog type of civil society and of independent media where corruption can be on the evening news. That's the actual goal of this type of governance. So if you want to support an outcome, a brighter future, please do support civil society and do support independent media. They are more reliable tools for a better future than any parties. Thank you.
Thank you.